Good evening, everyone. Here we are at the Poison Pen. We are so appreciative of the fact that Christopher Reich has driven a short distance over here from his home. And we have signed books fully masked. We have wonderful autographed copies for you of The Palace. And now we're going to do a live event in the store, which we haven't done for such a long time. What a treat, Chris.
It's so nice to be back, and especially under these circumstances. So thank you for having me.
It's really a pleasure, and I love this backdrop. Now, tell me, this is Bangkok, right?
This is Bangkok, and I spent about 4 months of the year, first 4 months of 2019 in Bangkok writing the book, kind of soaking up the atmosphere, getting ideas, and especially for the chase scenes. If you want a chase scene to be realistic, you need that really authentic local detail. And so you get it by walking around this city of 14, this teeming city of 14 million people. Hot, exciting, a little bit of a smog problem now and then, but I love the Thai people, and it was just a great experience.
It's a wonderful city. When I was there, which was a few years ago, I love this story, so I'm going to take a moment of your time because it's such a great story. And in fact, the Mandarin Oriental Hotel figures into the palace, right? But my trip to Bangkok was in conjunction with the first cruise down the Irrawaddy from Mandalay to Rangoon, and or I call them Mandalay and Rangoon, but it's now Yangon, I think. But anyway, in order to do that, we flew into Bangkok, and then we flew to Mandalay, came down the river. So the group that we were with booked us into the Hilton, which is along the bank of the Chao Phraya, and over there was the Mandarin Oriental, and then upriver, I think it was upriver, maybe downriver, and whatever, was the peninsula. So I'm sitting there in the Hilton looking across the river at the Mandarin Oriental and upriver at the peninsula, and I thought, why am I in the Hilton? So the river is actually the better highway in Bangkok, and hotels offer you little boats, sort of like Venice. So if the streets are so crowded, you can really make progress if you're on the river. So we took a river ride up and looked at the peninsula, and I looked at my husband and I said, we're coming back to Bangkok after we've done the Irrawaddy, and I want to move to the peninsula. My husband dug in his heels and said, no, we paid for the Hilton. I said, I don't really care, Rob. We might never be back to Bangkok. And traveling with us was our American Express travel agent, who spoke up and said, I have a great deal, she said, because the peninsula is one of those American Express hotels where you get all these benefits listing them. So I said, great, book it. So I won't say that he sulked, but there was a definite little frisson that went on. Everyone except me coming down the Irrawaddy got very ill because we were riding around in ox carts and bicycles, and there's a ton of dust. And everybody got this awful cough except me, including my husband. So as we're flying from Yangon back to Bangkok, he said to me, what a good thing we have two hotel rooms, he said. I'm going to stay at the Hilton, and you can move to the peninsula.
That's very funny.
Which I did. And after two nights, he kind of recovered. So the last night we were there, he moved in with me at the peninsula. We watched Goldfinger wrapped in blankets along the river because the mosquitoes are terrible, aren't they?
They are.
I mean, they're like really hungry mosquitoes. And the next day they were having riots, so the hotel put us in a limousine and took us to the airport. And when I got the bill, it was $300 a night for this incredible experience. And I have stayed in like mediocre hotels all over the world and more
price.
Money, indeed. You know? And so I thought, what if I had given in and resisted my nights at the peninsula? I would have never forgiven myself.
Well, you know, you say the peninsula, that hotel is near and dear to my heart. My brother worked at the peninsula in Hong Kong for 11 years.
Of course.
And we would always stay there. And so last year when we were there and Laura was with me, we were at the peninsula. We were not staying there. We were at the JW Marriott, where my good friend Peter Kapretz runs that hotel. You know, all the Swiss, it's the Swiss mafia who run these hotels. But there's no beating the peninsula, Barbara, period.
Absolutely anywhere. Not. I've had anywhere. Tea at the peninsula in Hong Kong, but on my various visits to Hong Kong, you know, I'm really glad I've gone to Hong Kong because I'm not sure.
What's happening now?
Yes. And the first time I was there was in 1997, and they had this huge clock down on the waterfront, and they were counting down the days.
So June 30th, 1997.
That's right. And I'm really happy to have seen it right then.
Right.
And then I've been back a couple of times, and the changes are extraordinary. But you know what's really extraordinary is what's happened in Kowloon over in Macau.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in Macau.
Yeah.
I'm not a gambler, so I was in Macau once in 1993, I think, but I imagine it's a different world.
Totally. It looks like Vegas. Mm-hmm. And yet when we went there, it still looked like Portugal.
Right.
So, you know, really, the changes in China are amazing. But Bangkok, I think, is a long way around here. Bangkok has largely stayed Bangkok, while other Asian cities are transforming.
They have they've been able to maintain a lot of their national culture. So when you're walking around there, you do feel like this is Thailand versus Singapore, which there's no trace of Singapore. When you're in Singapore, it's like Manhattan, but even better. I mean, it's the cleanest, the most modern, the most advanced city. And I always say Singapore, America could be like that if we hadn't spent $16 trillion on wars these last 20 years. It's so modern, so fantastic. So I'm a big fan of Singapore.
You know, I just read, I wish I could remember the book. In one of the premises of the book was that Singapore, it says, the author says, I have no personal knowledge, values order even over the rule of law. So they are so strict and they control things so well that they have.
Remember when they caned that American who spit bubblegum on the sidewalk?
I do.
I was actually for that. After having visited Singapore, I thought, I'll do it myself because it's such a beautiful city state. People follow the rules and to such great advantage. And the rules really aren't that onerous. It's basically just be a good citizen. And I don't think they're asking these people anything more than we should be asked here. So,
well, let's talk about the palace.
Sure.
Because after all, while we are here, now you go all over the globe. You go from Cannes, Singapore, London, Tel Aviv, Zurich, and Bangkok. And speaking of hotels, Phil Kerr wrote about one of his Bernie Gunther books, set at the Hotel du Cap.
Hotel du Cap.
And you spend a fair amount of time in the Hotel du Cap.
I do.
In this book.
Right.
And you even, in the acknowledgments, thank someone for his inside knowledge of the hotel. So tell us about this legendary hotel.
Well, the Hotel du Cap, which sits at the kind of point of the Cap d'Antibes, which is a little kind of isthmus or peninsula, I guess, in between Nice and Cannes, is really the most legendary hotel in the south of France. It's built in the style of like a 19th century French mansion. So it doesn't really look like a hotel, on beautiful landscape grounds, manicured lawns, big tall cypress trees, and right surrounded, of course, by the Mediterranean. And up until about 2 years ago, you could only pay cash there. It's where they hold all the big parties at the Cannes Film Festival, Harvey Weinstein, sorry. But everybody else, you know, Sharon Stone, when they have the big fundraisers, it's at the Hotel du Cap, excuse me. And it's just the place. You know, it's the place. I've stayed there one night in the company of my friend Charles Winkler, who I acknowledge. His family, who's a very prominent motion picture family, did all the Rocky movies and Raging Bull and Goodfellas. They go every year. They're there every year for a week to 10 days, and they kind of just decamp there. And so when I asked some questions about what does a key look like at the Hotel du Cap? Because is it just a touch key? I didn't need a touch key. I needed a real key for this plot point. He goes, you're in luck. And he amazingly, my friend had a picture of a key. For some reason, he had a picture of one of these keys. And so that point is authentic.
I love that. How wonderful. Well, of course, it won't be the same experience right at the moment if it's even open. But when we first met, because we met with your first book, which I absolutely loved,
you had
been in a career in Swiss banking.
Yes.
And you basically said, screw it, you know, I'm going to write great it books instead, which
yes.
I applaud. And in the plot, give us a rundown on the plot, because it taught me a lot of World War II history that had previously not come to my attention.
Well, the first book was called Numbered Account. And of course, you know, they say when you start out to be a writer, write what you know. And prior to deciding to leave my career, the career for which I had been trained and gotten an MBA and all this, I worked at the Union Bank of Switzerland for a number of years, first as a private banker and then in mergers and acquisitions. So when I started this book, I said, okay, I've been working in really one of the most secret, kind of confidential, murky environments, you know, that exists. I should draw my story from whence, you know, from what I know. So the story, Numbered Account, is about an American, Nick Newman, a former Marine, who goes and he has a career on Wall Street, and he leaves his career to take this job at this small secret Swiss bank to uncover the secret behind his father's death 20 years ago. And so it's kind of really a peek behind the curtains of what goes on in Swiss banks, how they work laundering money, how they help certain clients, you know, who remain nameless, take their money from whatever ill-begotten gains, arms trafficking, drug trafficking. But I think I was able to provide a level of detail that had not really been seen before in this type of book. And that's what made it so successful, is people could read this and it was not only a page turner, but it's like an eye opener. And it was a kind of a lesson, you know. You know, when you read like Dan Silva's books, they're always a history lesson. You're learning so many interesting things. And with Numbered Account, you were learning what really goes on in Swiss banks.
Absolutely. I mean, it was one of the reasons I love, I've read crime fiction all my life, in part because I like the educational aspects, which might not occur to many of you. But no, seriously, I have a mind just loaded with all sorts mm-hmm. of, you know, information I would absolutely never have acquired. Mm-hmm. You know,
so if the bookstore closes, it's Jewel Thief for you or whatever, well, a cat burglar.
Yep. And I brought up the banking because it's a critical part in the palace. You also yes. have to know how international banking works. But anyway, Simon Risk, this is your third book for Simon Risk, which is a great name. Risk with a K-E. I like that. R-I-S-K-E. Why did you decide suddenly to write, you know, about Simon? Because you've written a variety of books before.
I'd really concentrated, Barbara, early in my career on, first with Numbered Account, and then with my later books on these, I think the New York Times called them, you know, loyalty blurring, globe spanning, you know, betrayal novels, where they're just super intense books about geopolitical issues. And I noticed all of a sudden after about 10 of these that kind of the real world was surpassing me. It's like, I can't outthink the craziness that's going on. Plus, I just kind of come to the end of being so serious all the time in all these books. One of my books, The First Billion, I had turned in and I got a scathing letter from my editor saying, Chris, you know, your characters can't smile. They can't crack jokes. They can't, you know, give certain knowing glances. You know, it's like, this is, you know, pedal to the metal. Their life is at risk. Every page, go. And so I said, okay, I took that lesson to heart and applied that. But I wanted to write kind of a book that I used to love reading, with a little bit of tongue in cheek, fun, a very tough lead character, but one with more nuanced, you know. You think of more like a Cary Grant and To Catch a Thief, but with a little bit more muscle, a little grittier. And that's what I'm aiming for with Simon Risk. You know, he came from a good background, but then through circumstance, was thrust into the criminal underworld. He embraced it. He excelled in it. He became really like a made man in the milieu, which is the word for the French organized crime in Marseille. But then he had a change of heart. He was in prison and kind of found himself again. So I love this duality of him. Is he good or is he bad? And he's always fighting himself. You know, he wants to be good, but he knows he could be really bad.
Well, he can be really bad. And he picked up a lot of skills, I might say. He was really more a teenage gangster than, you know, a mature mm-hmm. gangster mm-hmm. until he got caught. And I thought in the palace, there's some very nice references back to what happened to him, his early life, because in fact, the revelation that he's been in prison destroyed his career as a banker mm-hmm. in London.
Yes.
And so he's embarked upon, and it's hard to know what to call him. I see him described differently. I've seen him described as a private spy. I've seen him described as, you know, he's kind of a fixer in a way.
He's a problem solver.
Yeah.
He solves problems for people that don't want to be seen to solve the problems for themselves. Intelligence agencies, multinational corporations, wealthy individuals. He's the guy you go to when you absolutely positively have to get the job done.
And you probably want plausible deniability. So when we see him in the palace, when it opens, he is on a yacht with a young woman who works in his car restoration business. And they are guests. So they're, you know, glamorous and gorgeous and all, but their real mission is to steal back a Monet painting, or a purported Monet painting, stolen from the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, and return it. And this is for what? Lloyd's of London, right?
Yes, that's his employer.
So it is a risk. I mean, because if the painting turns out not to be authentic, if it turns out to be a copy, then the Rijksmuseum doesn't have to give back its $15 million and he won't get paid.
Indeed, right? Yeah.
I didn't realize that part of the reason that Lloyd's was going after this, and I should have, was that they had paid the museum. And now that the painting was spotted on this mm-hmm. yacht in some social media, if you're a criminal, or if you've done something bad, you really need to avoid social media. Mm-hmm. Somebody sees mm-hmm. the painting in social media mm-hmm. on his yacht and
Indeed.
Says, whoa, maybe this is really the Manet. But I didn't think about the fact that having paid it out, mm-hmm. if the insurance company spots it.
They want it back, sure.
So the museum has to refund its money. And then the next question is, does the Rijksmuseum actually have the $15 million to pay him back? Because they probably spent it.
They probably have, but remember, in the time that that painting was gone, which is about 20 years, the value of a Monet has probably quintupled. So when the insurance company paid $15 million against it, now that painting is worth $80 million. So I don't think the museum will have too much problem, you know, raising the money to pay $15 million to get that painting back.
Yeah, but then they'd have to sell the painting.
Well, they probably have plenty of money. All these museums have gigantic endowments. Just look at our Metropolitan Museum in New York. So
very true. And I like the Rijksmuseum. Mm-hmm. I've been there before and after, and mm-hmm. I do think that the remodel mm-hmm. is interesting. It's a very old building, and I can see that security at the Rijksmuseum mm-hmm. could be difficult. Mm-hmm. So I'm
Indeed.
Not surprised. Anyway, you have this great opening scene, great chase scene, and they are, in fact, off Antibes, or off...
Right there, right very close to the Hotel du Cap.
Right.
Exactly.
And something goes wrong. And now we're back in London, and then what happens? Because that, what's the instigating incident?
The instigating incident is one of his old friends with whom he'd worked in a bank has been put in jail in Thailand. On the eve of opening a luxurious hotel, this kind of ne'er-do-well friend, Raphael de Bourbon, is all of a sudden arrested by the Thai police for seemingly no reason and thrown into just a hellhole of a prison in Bangkok. And he reaches out to his old friend and says, you have to come save me, you know, by the virtue of a few code words, letting him know that this is absolutely paramount. And of course, Simon then looks back on the past and he's an honorable man. He honors his obligation to his friend and goes out and sets on this quest, truly a quest to free his friend. And of course, complications ensue. And you know, the story goes from there.
It's a very complicated plot. Mm-hmm. Thai jails are, Thai prisons are notoriously awful.
Oh,
so
they are.
It's not a place that you would ever want to be. And the Thai police are notoriously both brutal and corrupt, or not all of them, but at least
right.
some of them.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not a good spot to be for his friend. But you know what you said? I think of Raphael as unlucky. I don't know that I think of him as a ne'er-do-well.
Well,
I think he's just unlucky.
You know, it's funny. When I wrote this book, you know, it's complicated, but I try not to make my books too complicated. You're basically following the trail of money. You know, where did this money disappear? And this book is based largely on this 1MB scandal, which is the one Malaysia scandal where the Malaysian finance minister was stealing from their sovereign wealth fund. And a lot of the characters are based straight out of that scandal. So, you know, Raphael was a guy that had a successful career, then moved to the Far East with his lovely wife and was trying this business and that and really just not finding his way anymore. And just on the eve of finding it, then, you know, a lot of good, about when good things are about to happen, then, you know, he gets caught in this trap, kind of his own making, but there you go.
Well, you do, or there he goes anyway. I thought
there
I
marked
the page, which is what I was looking for. But sovereign wealth fund is a relatively opaque concept to me. I haven't spent any time studying it. So since it's critical to the book,
right.
why don't you explain to us what
a
sovereign wealth fund is?
It's simply a fund where a country, Norway, Malaysia, China, Japan, they take money that's from their citizens, and then they invest it. I mean, these are billions of dollars, and they invest it either in their own country or in different investments that they think will yield, you know, nicely for them. So they'll raise like $5 billion and buy plots of land in Saudi Arabia to make sure they're earning money on oil investments. Norway, who has the biggest sovereign wealth fund per capita, I think each citizen is valued at $300,000 in value of this wealth fund per capita, and they invest in their own hydroelectric, but then also invest all over the world to diversify, okay? The problem with sovereign wealth funds is who controls them, okay? And in some of these countries in the Far East, Indonesia, Malaysia, a very few, very small number of people control these funds, where the money goes, with no one really checking, you know? There's no like inspector general looking over their shoulder saying, you know, what did you do and signing off on that? So there's this ability to take that money and use it for your own good. In this one scandal that I'm talking about, 1MB, the Malaysian finance minister took the $4 billion and basically put it in his pocket and said, and lied about where he was investing. He just gave $700 million to one son, $700 million to a nephew, and it just disappeared, and no one was really watching, okay? And that's real life.
So it's not a Ponzi scheme, it's a different thing. And is the idea to generate income from the government other than taxes?
Well, they use a lot of the taxes to invest in this, but they want to make more money than they would make. They don't want it to sit idle in a bank account earning 2%. So just like with any portfolio, you have some in gold, some in stocks, and some in more higher risk investments. And I think the sovereign wealth fund might constitute, depending upon how they want to set it up, a higher risk investment.
Right, I get it. And so part of the idea is to take some of the income and do what? Like infrastructure improvements?
They could build roads, they could build dams. Each fund is different, and each fund actually has usually a definition of what the money is raised for, the purposes, you know, what they're trying to invest in. So
does the United States have a sovereign wealth fund?
You know what? I don't think we do.
I don't either. And I have to say, I thought it was a very crude sort of attempt to do that. But this whole bit about TikTok, you know, going to Microsoft and Trump saying, you know, that the government ought to get a chunk of that was kind of a very... I thought ham-handed and very amateur way of trying to collect a little money. But the question is, who would watch it if the government got it? Where would it go and who would watch it? So I really have disliked this whole conversation that we've had about TikTok.
Indeed.
I mean, it's private enterprise. And
let it go.
I didn't think that the government... What's
the exact issue with that? They think that the software is somehow stealing data and giving it to the Chinese. I think there's some national security angle that I don't quite comprehend why we really object to TikTok.
Well,
I know it's owned by the Chinese.
Yeah, I don't have a quarrel with that aspect of it, but I don't think that the sale of TikTok to Microsoft is the government. I don't think it's government intervention.
Sure.
No, I'm not a full-fledged capitalist. Mm-hmm. Some degree I am, but I just don't see, you know, why there should be a payoff to the government.
Well, agreed. We don't have to make this a political conversation, but
no.
I'm on your side.
All right. Just, you know, a little bit I know about finance. That doesn't sit with me at all. So in this book, you have an opportunity to take us to a lot of places. Now, there's a very brief mountain climbing scene that does not
there is.
End well.
Doesn't end well, exactly.
Characters. Are you a climber?
I am, more in the past than in the present, but I've been at a lot of those places that I mentioned. And luckily, I didn't fall off the cliff. But it is fun, and you know, one of the joys I have in writing these books is in including the places I've traveled and being able to add a little bit of insight into what these places are really like, more than you could just get on the internet looking at pictures and maybe reading from the Lonely Planet or this and that. So I try to put in like the knowing detail about what's it really like to be in Bangkok and smell and all the motorcycles they have and, you know, just the stuff you've seen. And then the book goes from Bangkok to Malaysia to Singapore. And then back to Europe, to Switzerland, and then finally to France. So yeah, they're fun. I love when I'm reading a book that it takes me on to places I haven't been before. Right. And now that I'm at my age and my daughters are in college in a way, I'm finally able really to live this life of an author, you know? Like Robert Louis Stevenson, I remember, he went and lived in the South Pacific, you know? He died in Fiji or Samoa somewhere.
Vanuatu,
on some hilltop, right? And indeed, so that I'm trying to a little bit emulate some of the people I loved, you know, reading. And I just love traveling. Like you, we share that travel bug.
Boy, isn't that the truth? And I thought about that when I came down here. Mm-hmm. I never have time to go shopping because I work all the time when I'm here in Scottsdale. So if you take me from the bottom up, the shoes I bought in Stockholm, Sweden, the pants I bought in Bordeaux, France, my top is from Évora, Portugal, my earrings come from a boutique on the side of Lake Como. My ring I had made in Santiago, Chile.
It's amazing.
At an artisan market. And my bracelets are from Santiago de Compostela, Spain. So I miss travel to a large
You're just like a human United Nations right there.
It's interesting how people like to buy, you know, souvenirs from travel. Mm-hmm. Our house is completely full of art. We have tchotchkes everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I buy things to wear. Because, you know, when I put them on, I remember that I've been there. And they're, so basically, I'm a walking souvenir, you know.
Isn't that nice, though?
And, well, it is nice. And I miss that. I really do.
Americans aren't really welcome anywhere these days, at least not for a while.
No. No, I don't. I am not prepared to travel just at the moment. I just turned down the first Northeast Passage cruise with Crystal. We took the Northwest Passage cruise. This one goes from Siberia to Tromsø, Norway, across of Russia. But I've actually been up Norway and all the way east to Murmansk, and it's not paradise.
But you don't want to be on a boat regardless these days.
No, I really do not. Yeah. So tell us what may be up with video, you know, television, movies, something interesting.
Things are good. I've been having a very good year in the filmed entertainment arena. Two things. One, they will be making a television series out of the Simon Risk books, which is great. And it's from the team that does Jack Ryan on Amazon Prime.
Which one? The Jack Ryan Jr.?
The Jack Ryan with John Krasinski.
No, that's Jack Jr.
Oh, is it Jr.?
Yeah, right. It's the second one was in Venezuela with a somewhat, in my view, incredible plot.
Well, it's the same series. It's the same, same guys. Yeah. And that's Amy Powell. And then they brought on Mark Evans, who used to be president of Paramount, to produce my work. And so it's being written right now. We have a great showrunner. We have a very famous motion picture star attached. I'm not allowed to reveal it until it's set, but I couldn't imagine a better star. You know, I really never imagine someone famous when I write my characters, but now that the character is written and on the page, when I heard that this young man was going to become Simon Risk, I thought, wow. That is exactly how I envisioned him. Not just how he looks, but his persona too, which is classy, but tough as nails. And so I love that. And then also we're going to be doing something with my Jonathan Ransom books, which were so successful. The Rules of Deception, Rules of Vengeance. And another, this is going to be filmed entertainment. It's going to be 2-hour movies for Netflix, starring also a well-known, very well-known British actor. Again, I can't say until we make the official announcement. So I've had two great things happen recently. So very happy.
You know, honestly, these streaming services have created a demand for content that is absolutely a boon for authors. Mm-hmm. It's fabulous.
It's like a hurricane. They just are snapping up properties. And it's happening so quickly, too, because the COVID-19 has really changed people's viewing habits. You know, the number of subscriptions on these streaming services has skyrocketed. Just look at Disney Plus and look at the Disney stock today. So they're just dying for content. And in certain kinds, it's interesting, a lot of the movies and the projects that are very successful on these would probably not be as successful in movie theaters because they'd be subject to a lot of critical comment before. A lot of these movies maybe wouldn't get the best critiques, but they get 90 million viewers. And in the end, that's what they're looking at. You know, they're looking at a movie that this 90 million people watch this movie. We want to make another movie like this movie that's going to attract 90 million more, plus 10 million more new subscribers. So it really has changed things. Often when people read my books, they say, Chris, your books read like screenplays. And so that's turned out really nicely for me that I think film executives read it and say, I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to just write the screenplay from the story, you know. A lot of my books were optioned before Tom Cruise had to, Patriots Club and Devil's Banker, Lorenzo de Bonaventura, Paramount had this Rules of Deception series. And they always struggled with adapting the books because they were trying to change them a lot. And I remember finally I met with Lorenzo, the producer. He says, he hired a second screenwriter and said, just write the book, you know, it's in there. So hopefully they'll follow that and it will turn out well.
Well, I think that serial television does far more justice to a novel and a series because you don't have to cram it all in to the much shorter film format. And so I do think that series, you know, that they can build on where they do season 1, 2, 3, and 6 episodes. is amazing. Patrick, do you have any comments or questions you'd like to bring up?
Really, a lot of people are watching, but...
Right. Ready for questions. Anything you want to say?
I have one to ask you. What are you working on now?
I am about to decamp up into my mountain hideout to finish Simon Risk 4. The title is Once a Thief. And it's where Simon really goes to the dark side. And it's very fun to write because I don't have to worry about him being good anymore. It's like he can just let it loose, you know? He could let his bad guy flag fly. And so I have to go finish that up right now. And that has to be done by October 15th. So I'll see you then.
You do have some. And then you're also finishing a book for Audible.com.
Yes.
Everything She Always Wanted. Who's Indeed. Going to be reading that?
Candace Bergen will be reading that. A close family friend who's been a fan for me of my work forever, basically. And as I was writing this, it's the first book that I've written from a female's point of view. In fact, there's two female leads, a business, a little bit of a parody, but a business kind of murder mystery on these business books written by like Sheryl Sandberg. But there's a murder thrown in. And so there's this female executive and there's the female New York City detective that's after her. And as I was writing this, I was thinking of Candy's voice in her kind of sarcastic, caustic voice, all-knowing. Is the cop, and I called her, I said, you have to read this because I wrote it for you, basically. And she took a look and she goes, oh my God, I love this, it's so funny. And because it's funny and exciting, but there's a lot of big laughs in it. And so it's basically like nothing I've ever written, and which is a bit of a challenge, and I hope the audience will follow it. But yes, so we're gonna be recording that very soon.
Wow, well, I didn't realize you were gonna have all this good news to bring.
It's been a busy year. Do I look tired?
Stories, you know, I think it's wonderful to watch them on different platforms. You know, reading a book is a different experience than watching a video and a different experience than listening to a story. So, you know, it's wonderful that all of technology today mm-hmm. is giving us the opportunity to experience your books.
Well, that books on tape market is exploding. So Audible.com, their business is growing 15-20% a year. More and more people are listening to books on tape, which is great. So one of my former editors, Stacey Creamer, brilliant lady who did my Rules of Deception series, she is one of the top people at Audible, and she's completely, I don't think she reads books anymore. She is constantly listening to something on tape. She's a great runner, really one of the best in her class in the whole country for her age. And she just always has books on tape in her ear. And she said, Chris, I have this kind of idea that maybe we could write something based on your business, you know, knowledge, but with this kind of unreliable female narrator. You know, do you think you're up for it? And I said, well, I'll try. And with her help, it turned out very nicely.
Wow, so it's kind of like Lean In with Bodies.
It's like Lean In with Bodies.
That's a great line. I'm giving it to you.
It is. Thank you. We'll take it. Lean In with Dead Bodies.
All right. So anything you'd like to share there, Patrick, before we sign off?
Yeah. There's a question from Mark. He asks, what authors do you like to read?
Oh. Gosh, I mean, I'm a big Lee Child fan. I just was actually reading Larry McMurtry, which is, of course, totally different. You know, The Lonesome Dove, I read all those books, his series. I read a lot of nonfiction now. I read primarily nonfiction for a number of reasons. One, I'm always looking for good ideas. And actually, I'm going to be starting a new series after the Simon Risk, starring a female Israeli operative, Danny Pine.
She's in this book,
and it's a little bit of a counter to Gabriel Alone, who I love Daniel Silva's books, and but I thought I want to bring a female perspective, and so I've been reading a lot, I mean tremendously, about Israel and the Mossad, and you know, I'm in awe, and I just read this great book by Stephen Pressfield, I think it's called Lion's Gate.
Yes.
About the 1967 war. I couldn't put it down. And hopefully my excitement will translate to this new book.
But you and I were talking before we started that mm-hmm. you really like the work of Alan First.
I love Alan First. I've read all of his books at least once, and a couple of them two or three times.
And Joseph Cannon.
I love Joseph Cannon as well. I mean, he's a fantastic, really super talented author. Yeah.
Istanbul Passage is my personal favorite Joseph Cannon. Mm-hmm. After Los Alamos, I think they're both mm-hmm. brilliant. And then the late Philip Kerr is another author we both agreed was marvelous. Well,
we love historical novels. I think we share that same taste. And there was no one better than, I think, all three of those. So we could put them together.
Absolutely. Magnificent. All right.
There's our recommendations right there.
I have a viewer here who says he really loves the financial kind of series that you did. Mm-hmm. Any chance that you might revisit that world again?
Right now, I mean, when you read The Palace, there's a big financial angle in here.
Really?
So all the Simon Risk book, he used to work in a bank, so you're going to learn something interesting about finance. The new book I'm writing, What's the Thief, he goes into the biggest money laundering operation, and I can't give any more hints, in the world, and it's so interesting how they do it. And I'm talking hundreds of billions of dollars. Wow. Okay, and if you know where that comes from, there's only one country it could come from, and he gets involved with that. So while I will not be doing a sequel to Numbered Account, at least right away, I do try to bring in a financial angle, because that's kind of my expertise into these books.
And, you know, there are lots of books about other aspects of international thriller writing, but I think the financial ones, there aren't enough people that really grasp it as well as you do. And so if it's there, it's more in the background, but it's not so intricate. But you made my heart stop. Are you going to leave Simon, or are you just going to digress?
No, I'm going to start doing 2 books a year.
Oh.
I'm okay. Keeping Simon, but thank you for saying that. And Simon in the summer, and Danny Pine in January, February.
So if you want to lead like the lifestyle of the famous author and travel the world now, why are you signing up for 2 books?
Because it's, I don't know. I amazingly, and I wish that happened a lot earlier, I am becoming much more prolific as I get older and able to write these books more quickly. And just kind of, there's never a formula you figure out, but I just concentrate more. Maybe it's because I don't have 2 little girls running in, my 2 lovely daughters who are now 20, almost 23 and almost 21. So I have more time. I just have a real thirst for knowledge and research and travel. I was planning on going to Tel Aviv in November for 3 or 4 months to write this new book. I don't think that's going to happen right now. So I will try to do it a little bit, remotely. But I don't know. I can't explain it, but it just makes me happy. And plus, I want to get back to the top of the bestseller list. And I think that the way you got to do it is to be on the tables in people's face, like David Baldacci, John Grisham, who's doing 2 books a year. And I can do it. So,
well, very true. We're, by the way, going to have our first event with John Grisham on October 14th. So that'll be fun to talk to him. I have a great story about John Grisham all the way back to his first book, which I will tell him when we do that. Uh-huh. But yeah, you're right. It takes not only a lot of books, but it takes a lot of promotional energy. But the real trick is to have television.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we're the Outlander bookstore, so we know all about the effect of television.
Indeed.
And I think that if these 2 things come to pass that you have mentioned, that you won't have to worry a whole lot about
bestseller
lists, but you will be under more pressure to provide more content.
Yes.
So that'd be really good. Anything else, Patrick?
That's about it.
Well, good.
Anything you'd like to bring up that I failed to cover?
I think we covered a lot. I just want to say thank you for having me. I love coming to Scottsdale. I love being in 109 degree heat. It's great, but it's dry heat. I love it here.
Well,
I love the big cactus and just always a pleasure.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have Chris. And I have to say that it's really been a treat to see an author in the bookstore. So what a wonderful experience that this has been. Chris,
thank you
very much for driving over. Please remember that we have autographed copies of The Palace, and now that you've heard about all the good things that are going to be happening, this is your chance to buy in early, and then you will be able to really, say, I knew Simon.
Have the first editions, which
Simon
is what you want.
When. You know, discovery is fun, but you have to pay attention in order to do that. So here's your chance. Anyway, hope you have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.